You're listening to the Podcast Network. Listen, learn, evolve.
There's got to be a better way to light up the world today. Something that we need, something safe and clean. Well, if you're searching, you can find the answer right before your eyes. It's atomic. It's atomic. There's no need to fear. We gotta let the whole world hear. It's atomic. It's atomic. It's atomic.
And now here's Rod Adams and Shane Brown with The Atomic Show.
It's atomic. It's atomic.
Hi, Shane. This is Rod Adams coming to you from Annapolis, Maryland.
Hi, Rod. This is Shane Brown coming to you from Los Lunas, New Mexico. And this is Atomic Show number 26.
26, yeah. Last week we had a little bit of an issue. Neither one of us were up to talking very much, so we quit. I hope that not too many of you missed us too badly, but appreciate some of the fact that people are making comments on a blog this last week or so.
I'd like to give a shout-out to Greg, who called me on my manufacturing extra roads in Amarillo named Helium. There is just a one. And I confirmed that, and he was right. But thanks for the comment.
Yeah, well, there's probably some other things in Amarillo named Helium. It's just getting confused there.
Oh, yeah. So there's certainly a lot of history there. And I asked him a question in the comment this morning about whether he knew of any helium industry museums that would in Amarillo. So the next time my wife and I are passing through and we're staying there, staying the night there, we could go there before dinner or whatever. But we'll see.
You know, it's kind of interesting. Hadn't really thought too much about helium, except for the fact that we've talked a little bit about my notion that helium probably indicates that somewhere buried deep in the ground near the helium deposits that are bubbling up with the natural gas, there must be some alpha emitters like thorium and uranium.
Mm-hmm.
But I was reading an interesting article on Energy Pulse about Russian natural gas production in what's known as the Russian Far East, RFE, out in Sakhalin and Kamchatka and near Vladivostok and that kind of stuff. And
huge numbers of bears, volcanoes, and trees.
Yeah, that's
true. Among other things.
But I learned something about the natural gas there. Apparently, it has almost as much helium in it as some of the stuff near Amarillo.
Yep, I was also reading the other article that you forwarded me. It's the TNK BPM News, April 2006. It's talking about BP being interested in the development of the Kovikta field, I suppose it's pronounced. Any Russian speakers are more than welcome to email in and correct my pronunciation. So the article I'm looking at, the TNK BP interview, appears to be between a BP representative and someone who is in negotiations with Gazprom. And it's an interesting interview in that repeatedly the person doing the interview asks questions that the other person does not answer, citing proprietary information or citing various hard limits on what he or she can say. And what got me about the article was that Russia seems to be in the same position as the United States in terms of not considering the helium to be all that particularly useful as an immediate market value material. Go ahead.
I was just going to say that's the case right now. I mean, there is a market for helium, and it's understood how much helium gets sold every year. So the recognition is that right now there's more helium production capability than there is demand for helium.
Yep. So a good portion of the article gets spent talking about the different schemes that they're considering at the field and nearby for storing the helium in some kind of strategic reserve for a day when the market price of helium would potentially be much higher, rather than just venting it off into the atmosphere. And then because helium is so light, it would go straight out of the atmosphere and straight into space, and it would not come back.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that I found interesting was there was a very small comment, almost hidden in there, that said something to the effect of, there is an indication there might be an international customer for the helium somewhere in the time period around 2010, 2011.
I have three guesses for who that customer would be, and they all are the same. And they're located in South Africa, and they're developing a certain advanced variety of gas-cooled reactor.
Jeez, a man after my own thoughts. Yes, see. I've said several times in various forums, either written or oral, that I believe that the supply of helium might be a limiting factor for the development of high-temperature gas reactors of the pebble bed variety and the varieties proposed by General Atomics. And I might, at this very point, have to start chewing on my own shoes, because I ignored one of my own principles when I made those comments, and one of them is that the world, the Earth, is a very large and heterogeneous place, but one of my principles is that things that you find in one place, naturally occurring elements and compounds and that kind of stuff, probably are not only going to be found in one location. There's probably other formations and other places on this large rocky globe that we live on that have the same or similar geology. So there's an area in the world where we know that there's been helium, and we produce an awful lot of it in the area near Amarillo, Texas. But that's probably not a unique formation.
Indeed not. It'd be an interesting project for some geologists to look at what might be similar in the geology and the underground structures of the two areas, and see what's similar and see if they can correlate and find other places, assuming, of course, that helium became much more heavily prized than it is now. And helium certainly has a lot of nice properties as a coolant for nuclear reactors. Number one, no matter how long it spends in the reactor, it is totally inert chemically, as a noble gas as you'd expect, but also from a nuclear standpoint. It does not matter how long it spends in the reactor, it will not turn radioactive. It can carry radioactive materials. If there would be some dust formed, it could carry it out through the coolant loop and contaminate the coolant. But itself, it does not become radioactive. Plus, it also has some other neat properties, in that the speed of sound in helium is about three times higher than it is in air, which is one of the reasons why divers who breathe trimix when they're on electronic communications, they sound very, very, that and also the density. It's the reason why they sound like Donald Duck or Mickey Mouse. Their voices get massively shifted up.
I thought they sounded more like the chipmunks myself, but...
Yeah, so the other...
Every time I think about helium and making sounds, I have this image from an amazing event in my high school career. Didn't mean much to most people, but I still think of it as hilariously funny. A classmate of mine found a cello sitting in the back of a physics lab.
Uh-oh.
I don't know why a cello was in the back of a physics lab, but next to the cello there was a bottle of helium. And so he...
And the light went on.
He decided that he would play the cello like a guitar and suck on the helium and sing "It Ain't Nothing But a Hound Dog." But anyway.
Those are the kinds of memories that can last a lifetime.
So,
visual scarring, maybe.
Yeah, well, you know, that's what geeks do. They get weird memories, but...
Right. So the other thing about helium, besides the inertness, is that it can carry a huge amount of heat. And that's the other problem that it has for divers, is that divers who breathe helium are are at a much somewhat elevated risk for hypothermia because they can actually lose much more heat from their lungs than they do from their skin to the water.
Yeah, the specific heat of helium is 5 times as high as air is. So that means it can move 5 times as much heat per unit mass. However, of course, helium is 1/7 as heavy as air, so in a convection cooling situation, you have to move a little bit more volume of helium than you do air at the same pressure.
Right. Plus, there's the problem that there are no gas turbines that are presently designed to use helium as a working fluid other than at the research level in just a few places in the world, other than, of course, the effort that PBMR is putting into it.
Yeah, I think that PBMR and MHI, Mitsubishi Heavy Industries, and Westinghouse are going to figure out a way to build some really nice helium turbo machinery for the pebble bed modular reactor. And of course, there's helium I can't think of the word. Let's say like a pump. It's a helium blower, I guess.
Oh, compressor.
Well, it's not quite a compressor, but it just moves a lot of helium around in the loop for, like, the Chinese pebble bed reactor and the operating Japanese high-temperature gas reactor. And, of course, the...
Call it a blower,
circulators.
Circulators.
That's
okay.
What they called them that at Fort St. Vrain, which was the only, well, the, one of the two high-temperature gas reactors built in the U.S.,
There's a fact I did not know about. Apparently, in all the years I've done of reading on the topic of gas-cooled reactors, the need for a circulator apparently never entered my consciousness. I just figured that either side of the compressor and turbine would provide more than enough draw to keep the gas moving through the rest of the system, but obviously that isn't the case.
It does in a direct cycle. The circulators are the equivalent of the reactor coolant pumps for the high-temperature gas reactors that use a steam plant secondary.
Oh.
Remember, the Fort St. Vrain reactor had a helium primary circuit, which is roughly analogous to the primary circuit in a pressurized water reactor. And the helium flowed through a heat exchanger. On the other side of the heat exchanger, there was water that turned into steam. And
did
that
a heat exchanger look anything like a steam generator that you'd see in, say, a PWR?
On the outside, sure. It was just a big, heat exchanger, big tank. On the inside, the tubes were a different shape. They were a helical coil rather than a U-tube that you're used to for a pressurized water reactor.
Right, because in order to get the heat out of the helium going from a gas to a liquid, you have to have a much longer dwell time, so you have to make it spend more time. So.
Yeah, it gave a much longer flow path inside the heat exchanger. Those are what are considered to be the first step in high-temperature gas reactors, and there are, of course, there was the Fort St. Vrain reactor, the Peach Bottom reactor, and the Japanese have one that's operating, and, of course, the Chinese HTR-10 is a...
I thought the HTR-10 was a direct cycle, a pebble bed prove-out.
They have plans to make it a direct cycle. It's, of course, a test bed, but the initial one has got a steam plant secondary.
Hmm. Are there any efficiency hits from that you would expect going from, say, a water-to-water to a helium-to-water, a heat exchanger?
Well, like you said, you have to design the heat exchanger differently, but for the Fort St. Vrain reactor and the Japanese high-temperature reactor, one advantage of the high-temperature gas reactor is that you have a higher quality steam than you do in a pressurized water reactor, because you don't have to maintain the gas at as high a pressure. It can withstand a much higher temperature. So I think Fort St. Vrain operated with a steam temperature more on the lines of 600 degrees Fahrenheit rather than what you see typically in a pressurized water reactor, which is about 100 degrees lower than that.
And that's quite a good bit lower than the kinds of steam temperatures you see in a coal plant. And coal plant steam temperatures, as I recall, get up towards 1,000 degrees Fahrenheit.
That's correct. They use a lot of coal plants these days are using supercritical steam, and that's part of why they're slightly more thermally efficient than a nuclear power plant.
Neat. So we had a point that before we wandered off into the weeds.
I think there was one of the points I was going to make was, first of all, helium is not as big a limitation as I thought it was going to be. But the other part of this discussion was that there is still a lot of natural gas that is in areas where there's not a huge demand, and that's one of the reasons why there's so much marketing of natural gas for various areas and so much marketing of things like liquefied natural gas and that kind of stuff.
I wonder what the interest is in with the Gazprom people and the people who are developing Sakhalin Island in marketing to the Japanese. And Sakhalin Island is directly north of Hokkaido, which is the northernmost island in Japan. As a matter of fact, it's part of the same volcano chain.
Yep.
It's right next door, and yet it has huge amounts of natural gas, and they have this enormous natural gas consumer sitting right next door. It seems kind of strange for them to be trying to look farther afield with LNG.
Well, of course, they're also looking at another close neighbor like Korea. South Korea is a big consumer of natural gas, and they're probably one of the largest consumers of liquefied natural gas in the world. I would imagine that there's probably some long-time animosity and concern among the Japanese with regard to becoming dependent upon Russia for natural gas. First of all, Japan has often claimed Sakhalin Island as their own, and there's been a long-time territorial dispute over the Kurile Islands, which are also close by.
Right.
So,
although the Kurile Islands are a little bit more difficult, as a matter of fact, the Kurile Islands have some of the highest numbers and highest magnitude earthquakes in the world. The earthquakes that strike those islands are regularly in the 8.5 plus 2, sometimes 9 on the Richter scale. It's almost impossible to build anything on those islands.
Hmm. Interesting. Now that you mentioned the volcanic activity around Sakhalin Island, I wonder if that helps to explain the high concentration of helium in the natural gas.
It could be. Volcanoes and natural vents from geothermal facilities often have helium that's brought up from depth, and that's one of the few places where helium-3 trace gases are extracted from when they're trying to figure out age of rocks, and geophysicists like Dr. Herndon are trying to figure out what's going on in the core of the Earth.
It's interesting, because as we've talked about when we talked about the georeactor, there is indication that the core of the Earth has an awful lot of uranium and thorium in it.
Yeah. So one other topic we wanted to talk about tonight. There's obviously a lot that's going on with new nuclear reactor developments, and the industry is spooling back up for a second renaissance. And there's starting to be some pushback. And I was primarily looking at the Northeast and the Google alerts that you sent. There's one article that was actually an op-ed in the Philadelphia Inquirer by a lady named Nancy Kim Harvin. I don't know if you got a chance to read through that.
I think I did, but go ahead and remind me what you're talking about.
So she was claiming that in the op-ed that the merger between the New Jersey State Board of Public Utilities and Exelon was, as I read the article, was being driven by industry pressure to bring in, to keep online and bring more nuclear power online. And she claims that there are being corners being cut, and the NRC is looking the other way, and all kinds of, given what I know of the NRC, really outrageous things in the op-ed. And it was primarily just a power grab trying to shaft the consumers in New Jersey.
Well, there will always be comments like that, and I tend to think that the criticism of the NRC as a handmaiden of the nuclear industry and that kind of stuff is kind of equivalent to fans who like to yell at referees and try to persuade them that their calls are being unfair. And there will always be people who are going to yell at the NRC and say that they're biased one way or the other. And I recognize that there is some grounds for saying that there is a close relationship between the people who are in the nuclear industry and the people who are nuclear industry regulators. And that close relationship is not only important, but logical, and something that I think ought to be encouraged to a certain extent.
Right. And as I recall from Rickover's biography, he was one of the original people who was against that sort of regulators and industry participants working more closely together. As I recall, in Rickover Effect, he said at one point, "I don't even want your dogs to play with their dogs." Speaking with people from naval reactors who were going in and talking with the union representatives.
Well, Rickover was a particularly antisocial person to begin with, so he didn't like to associate with very many people. So that's, you got to take a little bit of the grain of salt.
Yeah.
When it comes down to it, the nuclear energy and nuclear engineering field in the United States is a pretty tightly knit and small group of people that often have gone through between 5 and 10 years worth of school together, gone to conferences, seen each other, and some of them, after graduation, choose to work for the government, and some choose to work for industry, and some of them go from one to the other. It is a reasonable and logical career path. I mean, the nuclear industry certainly needs people who understand the ins and outs of the regulations, and the people who are regulators need to have people who understand the ins and outs of things like construction, welding, actually, you know, keeping power available and plant operation and those kinds of things. So, and of course, both the regulators and the industry do actively recruit former nuclear Navy people. So, once again, there's a lot of in common between them. I would hate for people to assume that to be a qualified NRC regulator, you will have had to know no professional nuclear engineers in industry, and you will have to know little to nothing about or have no desire for nuclear power to succeed. That would be a terrible qualification to be a regulator.
I think a much better model. I mean, the NRC is definitely a good. I think the NRC does an excellent job now. I mean, they dot their I's and cross their T's. The FAA, coming from the aero standpoint, the FAA actively encourages the aeronautical engineer community, and it encourages the aerospace manufacturers. They do not take the position that flight is a necessary evil, but we will do our best to regulate it out of existence. Not to say that that's what the NRC is doing, but that seems to be the point of view of people who see the NRC being too cushy. And I just don't see that.
Well, I believe that there have been times in the NRC's history where that was a prevailing attitude of the people who were chosen to be commissioners. I believe that there is at least one commissioner on the NRC today who has that attitude. He shall remain nameless, but he used to work for a senator from Utah. I'm sorry. He used to work for a senator from Nevada.
Ah. The picture becomes clearer, but we'll let our listeners do their own research. That's part of what this podcast is about.
Yes. I did listen to that man talk. He has a interesting way of wanting to hug the industry to death, but and he doesn't understand why people want to keep to schedules and those kinds of things. He said we should investigate all questions until we have all of the answers.
Certain kinds of hugs can be hazardous to your health. Just ask any practitioner of judo and choking.
Indeed. I think he's probably one of the people who subscribes to the philosophy of keep your friends close and your enemies closer.
Some jolly people we deal with.
Yeah. Well, I keep warning people. People who are in favor of nuclear energy have to recognize that there are people who have plenty of logical, financial reasons for opposing it. Okay, so I did read another interesting article about the model that Constellation Energy is developing with their partners, Aruba, in the Unistar Corporation. I had the opportunity back when I was in Amelia Island a couple weeks ago to listen to Mike Wallace, who is the head of Constellation Generating, talk about that model. And their philosophy is that, I mean, he wants to go back to his roots, which is from the nuclear Navy, where the operators are taught how to operate and maintain their plants and not taught how to modify them, and that there will be a centralized within the group of reactors that they build, centralized engineering group that does all of the design modifications and interactions with the NRC on those kinds of issues.
So what is his reason for this philosophy?
Well, it's that standardization is the way that you can bring the cost down. If you build the same model over and over again, and then if you have lessons learned from one model, you apply them to all the others in that same series, then you
you work your way down the price curve.
Right, you have better economies. And one of the things that he said in his presentation at Amelia Island was to think about the idea of having a series of machines. And certainly you may learn things that you want to incorporate in a new version, but you continue building the series that you have proven and licensed while you're working on the design for the new one. You don't stop building and then try to apply all of the things that you've learned to the models from a previous year. You know, just for example, just because General Motors comes up with a better braking system in 1999, they didn't go back and apply that braking system to all of their 1995 existing models. And there was no need to.
Yeah. I mean, there's a need for that sort of thing with component recalls and product recalls, but that's a very minor, small fraction of what they put out, and there's no way logistically they could do that anyway.
Right. Another interesting part of his presentation was that anybody who comes in as a potential purchaser of this U.S. EPR, which is a product that they're working on, the U.S. Evolutionary Power Reactor, is a partner in the decision making process. But as they come in, they have to accept all previous decisions as already being made, and not try to go back and change the design that's already been agreed upon by everybody else. And
it sounds like a particular model of software development I'm aware of called a waterfall, mm-hmm. where basically you set your design in the beginning and then you iterate around that design and just proceed through design and gatherments requiring from your customers, and then the coding is actually a very small part and it falls into very discrete phases. Now, I have some disagreements with that model as applies to software, but software is not nuclear plant. So that definitely makes a lot more sense when you're dealing with a physical thing where it costs time and effort and sometimes blood for people to replicate it. Whereas with a computer, you can make a billion something just as easily as you can make one. It's just a matter of passing a different parameter.
Well, that's true to a certain point, but there are people who believe that replicating software is absolutely free, and that's not exactly the truth, particularly when you have to move it around.
Yeah, there's definitely lots of room to argue, and there's pluses and minuses to both sides of that argument. But the waterfall model, as I view it from the software world, and see the analogy with the nuclear system, it definitely makes sense from my point of view.
Yep. So there was another article from the guys who sponsored the MIT study of 2003.
Ooh.
Okay, the co-leads of that, and they have been talking about the need to go out and really start building a large number of nuclear plants. And one of the problems is that they keep referring back to their study of the economic comparison between nuclear, coal, and gas. And they do not admit some, or they do not talk about some of the limitations of that study and some of the assumptions in that model that have been overcome somewhat by events.
Like a rather unrealistic price per unit natural gas and oil?
Correct. The study of 2003, the MIT study, uses a natural gas model that starts in the high price model with $4.50 per million BTUs and escalates that again in the high inflation rate model. In their model was only 3%.
I'd like to have those high rates for my house this week, this winter.
Oh, absolutely. So,
quote unquote high.
And the other part of the model that I haven't really talked much about in any of my postings, but someday I'm going to get around to really analyzing all and publishing all of the things that I found in that model. The assumption in that model was not only does nuclear have a higher capital cost, but it also requires a higher percentage of the cost to be borrowed at a higher rate than the gas and oil. So the total cost of financing in the nuclear case was 10% per year, while gas and oil was under 8% per year.
Is that because of the time it takes to construct a nuclear plant compared to a gas or coal fired? Or
no.
Is it more capital, just sheer materials and all the capitalization?
No, it was based on an assumption that the lenders or the financial people that will be investing in nuclear power will be able to demand a higher interest rate, just as someone who sells an automobile to a person without a job demands a higher interest rate than someone who sells an automobile to someone with a good job and a high credit rating. It basically was saying that the nuclear industry has a lower credit rating than the gas industry. And I challenge that assumption, particularly based on my knowledge of the recent problems in the financial status of companies that were in the business of generating electricity using independent power producers that burn gas. An awful lot of those have gone bankrupt.
And the flagship example of that kind of company would be Enron.
Absolutely. But they're only one of many. There's Calpine. Duke Energy Services was a huge participant and almost put a good company into a bad situation. But there were others. And right now the capacity factor of the plants that were built under the assumption of low gas prices is running around 33%.
That's down around where you would expect a wind turbine facility to put in.
That's correct, but you know what the MIT model assumed for the capacity factor of a natural gas plant?
Probably in the high, better than two-thirds.
Yep, 75%.
And the reason why the capacity factors are so low is because they're having to operate in peaking, or they just can't afford to run all the time, or a combination.
Right. they cannot afford to run during periods of the year where electricity prices are low. So they shut down whenever they can. And what that does, if you have an asset that you're only able to use about half as much as you plan to, that means over the course of the year, if you're selling power at the same rate that you said you were going to sell it at, your revenue over the course of the year is half of what you expected.
Plus the wear and tear on the plant from starting up and shutting down and having to be mothballed if it goes into an extended shutdown.
That's correct. And if you have a capital asset that is mothballed, I don't think that the people that lent you money for that plant are going to be very happy about you not paying on a regular basis. Just as if you own a house and you have to move away and you can't sell your house and you can't rent it, the mortgage payments keep coming. So that's what's caused these companies to have real financial troubles. And what that does is it also puts into question the cost per kilowatt hour that was what was predicted in that model. Now, if you take the model, and I have taken their model and recreated it based on the information that they published in the report, you can do some interesting things and find out that the cost per kilowatt hour for a gas plant operating at 33% power with $7 per million BTU gas rather than $4.50 per million BTU gas has a significantly greater cost disadvantage to nuclear than was in the study. And that's ignoring all of the talk about coal. Some people believe that coal prices have remained stable.
They haven't. They've been going up.
That's right. If you stop your sample in 2003, you can say coal prices have been stable for the last 20 years. Since 2003, though, coal prices have done some rather interesting, had some rather interesting changes. If you want to find out about it, go take a look at the annual reports for companies like Peabody.
Not to mention the sheer number, if you were to count stories about quote-unquote big coal, if you just wanted to look at how much the media is covering them, I think the New York Times is now doing one coal story every couple weeks to maybe at the outside once a month, and it used to be that they just never covered it. I wonder whether there's some correlation between the increase in price of coal and the increased media attention that they're getting.
Well, of course, if you're talking about from major media like the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal, for people who write for those papers, covering an industry with a very steady price and a very steady demand and little growth prospects is not very interesting. But once it starts having some volatility and some changes in the growth prospects and some real jumps in the stock price, it's a much more interesting thing to discuss for the readers of those publications.
Just as a side question, how do you run these numbers when you take a look at these models? Do you do it with a spreadsheet, or do you do it with pencil and paper and calculator, or how do you do it?
I built a spreadsheet model that has all of the assumptions that the MIT model or the MIT study declared as their assumptions. And by doing that, you can build a model where you can vary inputs, you know, where you have all of the, you know, the various things that drive the price as inputs, and you just change those and watch how the model progresses. See how it runs out. The interesting thing about the model was, even in the MIT study, under the high price gas price model, high price gas case model, they were running gas plants at a loss after about 15 to 18 years, because as the inflation built the price of gas up, the price of gas was below the price of electricity they were assuming. But they assumed that the plant owner would continue doing that.
there are an awful lot of assumptions being made. When there are too many assumptions being made, my alert meter starts going off in the background.
Well, as an analyst, which is what I spend my day doing these days, I am always trying to get people to question assumptions. I guess I learned that from being a fan of Ayn Rand. One of the famous quotes in her book, The Fountainhead, was, if things are illogical, you must question your premise. Okay, if things look like they are not supposed to be happening, then probably the assumptions that made you think they were going to happen in the first place are wrong.
There's a good chunk of the beginning of John Galt's speech at the end of Atlas Shrugged that I think spent a lot of time on the same topic. It starts from the Aristotelian logic of A is A. And if you can start from there, you can build up anything. It's been a long time since I've read Atlas Shrugged.
Yeah.
It's been longer since I read Fountainhead.
Yeah, it's been a long time. Well, I read Fountainhead after I read Atlas Shrugged, but that's because I had a rather an education that didn't allow me the time to read those books while I was, in my education. I was reading too many other books, Shakespeare and that kind of stuff.
Right. Though I did get to see a production of Night of January 16th, I believe, was the play that she did. It was a murder mystery that involved Dagny Taggart a heroine based on her as a protagonist in the play. One of my friends was actually involved in the production of it at Mississippi College about 10 years ago. Turned out well.
Very good. Well, I can't seem to find. I should pull these things up before we start. But anyway, that's what I remember. And I'm gonna probably put together a nice real article on the assumptions and questioning those assumptions in the MIT study, because people keep quoting it as if it's
written in stone.
Whenever you're talking about the cost of anything, you must make sure you have recent data and real data. If somebody tells me that a house in a certain city costs a certain amount of money, I have to say, well, let's make sure that we're talking about the same exact location. There are many things that drive the price of things, and when you buy it, where you buy it, what the conditions are associated with the purchase, how much you buy, all kinds of things affect the price. And I guess part of that, my adamancy about that is, I used to be the guy who calculated the price of manufactured products. And it was always interesting when people came to me and asked me, well, how much does it cost? And of course, my first answer, which was always frustrating to them, was, it depends.
This is what engineers say, too.
Well, the variation of price is huge.
Oh, yeah.
Simply huge. How much does a liter of water cost? Well, it depends. What kind of brand do you want on it? What kind of fancy bottle do you want to put it in? Are you willing to carry your liter bottle and go to the closest well? Are you going to fill your bottle from a tap? Are you going to dip your liter into a lake? How are you going to get the water? Where do you want to drink it? Do you want the liter bottle with you when you're in the middle of a 4-mile hike?
About 30 seconds ago, most people would have said, just give me the bottle of water. There is a certain tendency that people have not to like detailed answers, and that tendency can be exploited. And it can be exploited for good, it can be exploited for ill, but question your assumptions and thinking about things. And it's the same thing with anything, especially if your life is on the line. Like, for instance, you go diving. You do not assume that your equipment is running because it ran fine the last time. You go over it because what you're breathing 70 feet down, and you really don't want to have to try to claw through the surface if your stuff goes away and your buddy is off someplace and you can't find them. Getting to the surface from 70 feet as a rocket is not any fun.
Yep. Well, I guess that's why aviators always take a walk around their planes, and about probably 99.95% of people on the road haven't looked at their tires in the last four or five times that they've gotten in the car.
If people drove cars the way pilots fly planes, the fatality rate in this country would be a lot lower.
Correct.
But that's a separate discussion.
All right. Hey, it's been a great talk tonight. I think that if I can get rid of all my stumblings, I will have succeeded in producing something worth listening to. But
cool.
It'll take me a while. Have a great week. And for all of you listeners out there, keep those cards and letters coming.
Absolutely. Have a good week, everybody.
Bye.
There's got to be a better way to light up the world today. Something that we need. Something safe and clean. Well, if you're searching, you can find the answer right before your eyes. It's atomic. It's atomic. There's no need to fear. We gotta let the whole world hear. It's atomic. It's atomic. It's atomic. It's atomic. It's atomic.
You're listening to the Podcast Network. Listen, learn, evolve.